Hey everyone, this is Josh, host of the Urban Valor Podcast. Today's guest is Navy veteran Tommy McConnell. Tommy grew up in Louisiana on a lake and was an avid swimmer. He was inspired to join the Navy by his Navy veteran grandfather. Tommy enlisted as a Navy diver, determined to test his physical capabilities. In this episode, he talks about the mental fortitude it took to become a Navy diver. After enduring strenuous physical activity to earn the title, Tommy was determined to make the Navy a career. However, he would be touched by turmoil after experiencing neurological symptoms that led to him finding out he was suffering from brain damage. Tommy leaves us with the mental struggle he faced after his military career ended abruptly. If you enjoyed this episode, go give us a 5-star rating and leave a comment to help support our veterans. The bigger the community, the bigger the impact. If you'd like to contribute your story to Urban Valor or know anyone else who may, reach out on Instagram at Urban Valor TV, or you can email me at josh@urbanvalor.com. Enjoy the show.
My name is Tommy McConnell. I was served in the United States Navy from May 5th, 2011 till January 28th, 2019. I was a Navy diver the entire time. I'm from Slidell, Louisiana, born and raised in Louisiana my whole life. I was born in Treasure Island, in a neighborhood called Treasure Island, which is directly on Lake Pontchartrain, which is a lake that separates New Orleans from the North Shore. And so I grew up swimming. I grew up playing on jet skis, wakeboarding, doing all those kind of things. I didn't know it at the time, but there's a lot of parts of my childhood that led up to me becoming a Navy diver that contributed to my success in the program when I first started swimming every weekend, winning swimming contests, winning ribbon after ribbon in freestyle. I stopped swimming when I hit about that teenage age, but I still had that background and I still had that muscle memory. From a very, very young age, my mom noticed that I wanted to be in the water. I wanted to swim. I had fun in the water. I grew up in Louisiana. I had no interest in fishing. I had interest in jumping in the water and swimming around and seeing how far I could hold my breath and reach it to the next pier over. You know, we grew up right on a lake, so we had piers lined up all along the lake. And so, yeah, that swimming and being underwater and just that was just kind of my thing growing up. Great early childhood. I would say it was around my adolescent years, my teen years, when things started falling apart from my mother and father, for really, really falling apart, where it was noticeable to my brother and myself. And when I was around that 14, 15, 16 teenage years, it was the sort of upbringing where you would hear my dad's truck pull up and my brother would come in my room. And he would sit on my couch and we'd play video games. We'd watch TV. He would just be with me because we knew within half an hour there'd be screaming in the house. And so, you know, it was a great childhood. As things went on, as time passed, you know, the marriage got worse and worse and worse. Little did I know that they were just waiting until we were 18 to split up. And it just got more and more toxic, more and more toxic, more. And it was, at first it was my mother, you know, everything was directed to my mother, but he would project the rest of that onto me and a little bit onto my brother. And then after Hurricane Katrina, I moved to New York for a little while, came back to Louisiana, and then it was just me and my dad. Well, Katrina was my first experience with a very close contact with the military. We lived in Slidell, so it was a little bit removed from South Louisiana. We didn't catch the brunt of it. We weren't in Chalmette. We weren't in the Ninth Ward of New Orleans East. That really got messed up, or the Gulf Coast. We were very lucky. We did get about 3 inches in our home, and went on our way. We evacuated to Mount Olive, Mississippi, where my grandma lived at the time. On our way back, my dad brought a chainsaw and had to cut through trees to get to our home. Very, very post-apocalyptic. People that hadn't seen each other were reuniting at Sam's Club and at Walmart, because those are the first places that opened. That's where the military kind of set up and were giving out waters and stuff. So you're kind of seeing people you hadn't seen. It was a moment where I walked outside my house and just kind of sat down and cried, because I had never seen so much destruction. And it was, imagine driving through a neighborhood and seeing everything that was on the inside of someone's house on the street. The sheetrock, the carpet, the toys, everything was just destroyed. After Hurricane Katrina, I moved to New York for a little while, came back to Louisiana, and then it was just me and my dad. And I was living in a house that he owned but didn't live at. And so he would just come around and just berate me and just scream at me. And there was one time, you know, he started dating someone. There was one time when, I love her now. She's kind of like my stepmother, but she had a picture of his girlfriend out, and I moved it around, and he just completely lost it on me, just screaming and screaming and screaming at the top of his lungs like a madman. At the time, you don't see that your parents are going through divorce. You don't get what's happening in their lives. Maybe this is like when I'm like about 20 years old. All I could tell from it was that my dad hates me. And that's what I got out of that. That's all I got out of it, was that my dad doesn't like me. I don't know what I've done wrong to deserve this, but I want to get away from him. Men at that age, that 18, 19 age, we seek brotherhood. We crave brotherhood. And so when the person you look to the most for brotherhood comfort, for fatherly comfort, just checks out emotionally, and not only that, berates you and makes you feel like nothing and makes you feel worthless, it messes with your head quite a bit. And so my childhood was awesome until those teenage years, until things got funky, until things got hairy. And then, you know, I kind of just became the black sheep. You know, I was into performing. I did theater all my life coming up. I did Music Man, Little Shop of Horrors, Peter Pan, Of Mice and Men, like quite a few different plays I performed in. And, you know, in high school and in like, you know, local theater, I had high hopes of being a comedian. That's what brought me out to New York after Hurricane Katrina. Kind of came back with my tail between my legs. You know, I didn't have the discipline to live out in New York on my own. And when I came back, I lived in my dad's house. And that's when things were really, really at their absolute most toxic. But then he gave me this weird olive branch. He was a welder. My dad was a welder my entire life. And he had the opportunity to go to Equatorial Guinea, Africa. He asked me if I wanted to come along as a hole watch, as like a fire watch, hand, whatever. And he's like, all right, Tommy, it's 12-hour days. You're going to make some money. This is real. We're going to go to Africa and do this thing. And I was like, okay, let's go. This is a testament to what a lot of guys say who have fathers like me, who have fathers that were boxers and fighters and tough guy kind of guys. You know, I know he loves me. He's got a funny way of showing it. And so here's how I'll paint that picture. We're out in Africa. We're working 12-hour days, long days. We get off, but I find out there's a rugby. They're playing rugby at night. And these are like people from like BP Oil, from Chevron, from wherever, Shell. And I go out there and I start playing with them. Well, I start doing good. And then they had me play one time. Then they saw me just walking. They're like, Tommy, rugby tonight? And I was like, yeah, let's play. So now I'm playing rugby every night with these guys, this group. And there's one play, the ball goes up. Me and this dude are both running full on, full sprint to the ball. We jump up in midair. We kind of collide. I hit my outside calf with his leg. We both fall to the ground. So it was one of those falls where we're both like getting up kind of slowly, like, shh, are you all right? I'm okay. Like, shake it off. Like, and so I'm getting up, I'm shaking myself off. And then all of a sudden my dad emerges. My dad just pops out of nowhere. And he's like, he kind of comes with a concern on his face. He's like, babe, you all right? You all right? And I was like, where did you come from? And he's like, I've been watching every time you play. Every night you play, I've been down here. He's been sitting under the bleachers. And I'm like, why wouldn't you just sit on the bleachers like a normal person? What are you hiding for, you know? And so that's kind of the kind of love my dad expresses. He cares, but he doesn't know how to show it. And so fast forward a little bit, worked in the restaurants. Another thing that primed me for the military was the restaurant that I worked at for the majority of my time when I lived in New Orleans. Was a very prominent restaurant. Our requirement to start work was have a crummer, a wine key, a cigar cutter, a lighter, three pins, a pad, and a crease right down the middle of our apron. And working at that restaurant, working at that house and that level of discipline was another thing that kind of got me ready for uniform inspections and stuff. And so that was another addition. So there was the swimming, there was the restaurant. And then there's also the trauma. Going into the military, my grandpa served. He was in the Navy a couple of years. And actually I have his tattoo on my left leg. I got his exact same tattoo. You know, I said to myself, I asked my grandpa, I said, yeah, I'm joining the Navy. I'm going to be a Navy diver. And he looked at me and he said, Tommy, you got to watch out, baby. You're not ready for that. They punch you right in the face in the Navy. You know, and I said, I'll be all right. And I'd read as much as I could about the program. And I'm like, there's no RDC. There's no instructor. There's no trainer who's going to scream at me and yell at me as bad as my own father has. So bring it. Let's do this shit. What inspired me to join the military was quite a few things. I would say it was my desire to get out of Slidell and get out of Louisiana. I always wanted to get out. I never felt like I quite belonged. Just wanting something new, wanting something different, wanting just a hard reset. Like, let's figure this out on our own and let's get out of here. Part of it was understanding what I was capable of, what I was most apt for. I mean, the first time I ever looked at any branch, I looked at the Army, and I was like, this isn't for me. And then I looked at Coast Guard, you know, all the other branches, the Air Force. This is not for me. This isn't for me. This isn't for me. I want to do what my grandpa did. I want to be in the Navy. But what do I want to do in the Navy? I don't want to just sign the line and go. I want something with a bit of a challenge that offers me a challenge. And I looked at EOD. I looked at SWCC. I looked at SEAL. I wasn't into that. I was never a shooter as a kid. I never grew up hunting or shooting, so I had no interest in guns. What I did like, though, was that there was a medical aspect to Navy diving. There was an engineering aspect to Navy diving, and that was told to me early on. And so at first, when I talked to the recruiters, they were like, what are you good at? I said, I'm a good swimmer. They said, we want you to be an air rescue swimmer. But I met a Navy diver while I was in the DEP program, and he kind of chatted me up about what entails in that job versus air rescue swimmer, and it just sounded more appealing to me, so I went in that direction. I met a great air rescue swimmer. He trained me. He would run with me. He'd swim with me. He helped get my PST scores up. So I signed up, and then I knew I had 7 months. I had 7 months before I left, before I got on the bus. And so I dedicated that 7 months to running and lifting and doing as much yoga as I possibly could. And that's exactly what I did. And so I knew if I did have a weak point, it was going to be the academic stuff. And so I made sure that I was in such good shape that nothing would stop me. There would never be a remediation of Tommy couldn't run fast enough or far enough or swim fast enough, because that isn't a factor. It would be, the classroom would be the factor. The boot camp experience, intimidating, frustrating, but everyone goes through it. It's a cross section of society that you meet. It's other people from other places. You know, you meet weird people, you meet cool people, you meet all kinds of people. And like, I try to have fun in any situation that I was in. And I had a buddy of mine who joined the exact same day from Louisiana. We became best friends in DEP. We were both going into divers, and he was exactly across the compartment from where I was. And so when we were lined up, when the RDC's backs were turned, we would stand to each other and play, rock, paper, scissors. And you got to know when to put your game face on and when you can clown around a little bit. And so I guess we got it. I just got through with a sense of humor. You know, I mean, I remember lining up behind guys, you know, nut to butt, you know, real close and stuff. You're in boot camp and being like, dude, I think there's a cat in the compartment. And be like, what? Like, yeah, man, there's like a cat running around in here. We got to find it. Like the guy in front of me being like, oh shit, hey man, there's a cat in here. Like I'd have the whole line, you know, being like, is there a cat in here? McConnell said there's a cat in here. There's no cat, you know, like just silly shit. So I guess, I don't know, man. It got serious. There was a moment, I remember I finally had boots on and I was marching and we're singing songs and I'm like, oh my God, this is real. Like, okay, all right, we're doing this now. And it was almost an emotional experience. It was like, holy moly, I'm in the freaking military. Like, this isn't Bourbon Street. This is the military. So yeah, I would say my boot camp experience was good, but I was so ready to wrap it up and get to the next phase. 6 weeks of dive prep. We started out with about, I'd say 36 candidates in the beginning, and went down to Panama City with about 12, 13. So they weeded quite a few people out. That was the most physically arduous part of the training. That was the part where, you know, you really saw people crack. You know, that final week when they were doing all the underwater stuff, the AAs and IWPs, you would see people walk off and go wherever they went, to back to their racks or the detailer, whatever, to say, hey, I'm quitting. So one of the exercises is an exercise where your hands are bound behind your back, your feet are tied, and they lump you in the water and they kind of lump you all together and they push you and they kind of say before this, hey, look, so, you know, stay calm and just chill out and relax and present your lungs to the surface, and they'll take you to the surface. And when you're ready to breathe, lift your head up and breathe. And then just stay there. Once everybody's settled down, we're going to start the clock for 5 minutes. I don't understand why, but being bound and tied in the water is a real deal breaker for some people. And it was. And I could hear people kick out of the constraints, swim to the side of the scupper and climb out and say IDUR. So that was a separator. That, and then tying knots, being able to chill out, swim down, tie a bowline, give an okay to your instructor, swim back to the surface, evacuate your snorkel and then give another okay. That was another one that it was just, holy moly, our group's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And it's weird to say, but you find strength in that. When you see people peeling off and saying, no, this isn't for me, this isn't for me, you lean into that more and say, this is for me. I'm gonna see it through to the very end. You know, that was like the prep experience. So you have like 6 weeks, and they call the last week the pool week, and you have different exercises you do. One would be like a snorkel porpoise, where you swim and you got to just come up to where your head and your snorkel come out of the water, blow out, go back down. And you do that for, I can't remember exactly how long, but that was another, you know, just aquatic exercise. It gets you accustomed and conditioned to breathing off of an air source instead of just being able to breathe. With people who don't snorkel very well, I've heard like, oh, it feels like I'm breathing out of a straw. I can't breathe enough. And it's because they never calm down. They can never settle it out. And so I always found peace in that environment. So that was always, it worked out well for me. Dive prep, the most challenging part for me was taking my mask and snorkel off and dropping it to the bottom and then putting it on and filling it up. Cause I had been practicing with an air rescue swimmer mask, and I was good at it. I'd done it 100 times. I rehearsed this movement that you had to do. And then they gave me this other mask that wouldn't clear, that like, it's like, no matter what I did, like no matter how much air I blew out of my nose, there would still be a little bit of water in the mask. And I'm like, I'm expelling my lungs here. Like I don't know how to get this little bead of water out. So what I did was I just brought my mask with me, my air rescue swimmer mask that I was used to working with when I had to come back. And cause they were like, all right, you're gonna have to do this again tomorrow. So I said, all right, well, I'm gonna do it, but I brought my mask. And they're like, you sure you want to use that mask? It's really high volume and it's got a lot of air inside of it. I'm like, no, this is the one I'm comfortable with. And I did it and I nailed it. And so that was the only pinch point that I had was the clearing the mask, giving the okay. Cause I don't know, trust your gear, you know, what you use the gear you're most comfortable with. And so that's exactly what I did and made it through. So after dive prep, they put you on a flight to Panama City, Florida. And that is where dive school, that's where official naval dive school starts. It's intense. It's intense from start to finish. I would say the intensity does dial back a little bit towards the end. But when you get off that bus, it's, you know, you're in your dress whites and it's a hardcore inspection. You get these instructors are kind of letting you know exactly what you've just stepped into and what you're about to face for the next, you know, however many months you're in the program for. They put you through the ringer when you first get there. There's a PSC you do initially. You got to pass your PSC. There's base swims you got to do daily. There's, you know, it's basically exercise and then a classroom portion at some point in the day. And my hardest point was learning to add and subtract time and fill out those dive tables. If a diver leaves this time, when is he going to reach this time? It was like these equations that just came at me way, way, way too fast. And actually rolled back a class. I spent my time waiting for that new class to class up, studying. They had another guy who had gotten enrolled for a medical reason, but they were gonna keep him around, but he was really smart and I knew he was smart. And so I kind of clung to him and I was like, can you please just give me a left surfaced, reach surfaced. And he did, and we started working through the equations together, and I started getting it. The next class started up, blew through without a hitch. Didn't really have a problem at all. The very end of the class is when they do the pool week where you're actually on scuba. There's lots of areas where we can PT. There's one area that a lot of divers are familiar with called Thor's Playground. And so there's these buckets filled with, these 5 gallon buckets filled with cement balls, there's chains to drag, there's pull up bars, there's ropes to climb. And so going back to Thor's Playground was the hard part, was like, okay, now we're digging, now we're crawling through the sand. And this wasn't aquatic. You know, anytime they say, all right, we're going to do wetsuit appreciation, we're going to put our scuba jugs on and swim the bay, I was like, all right, let's go. You know, I was happy about that. You know, well, oh, the water's cold, whatever, let's get in. You know, crawling through the sand, jumping over hurdles, you know, those are the exercises that were like, oh man, when is it going to be over with? It tests your personality and your grit. And there was a moment where I was terrified of it. I had failed a test. There was a small fraction in time where I was like, oh man, are they going to roll me or are they going to drop me? And I was terrified. And I found a friend of mine who had been really close to me from the beginning, you know, from, you know, boot camp and stuff. And I was like, dude, I'm like, I'm just going to ask them if they can let me be an air rescue swimmer, if they're going to roll me. Like, I still want to be in this program. I'm freaking terrified right now. And my buddy, he's like the most happy guy. But I saw this side of him where he like almost grabbed me by my collar and was like, you showed up here. You came to Panama to be a fucking Navy diver. And that's what you're going to do, Tommy. You're going to be a Navy diver. Forget everything else. Forget air rescue swimmer. That's not you. You're here. You're at the schoolhouse in Panama. So don't give up. Don't quit. You got rolled back. So what? Forget about it. Let's keep going. And I almost quit on myself. And thank God you have your brothers around you to kind of talk you back to earth. One of the events that happened during dive school is I was diving the Mark 20. It's basically a full face mask dive apparatus with a spider strap on the back of it that you can put at the back of your head. And we were in these things called pods. Dive pods. They're just dive pods where you can conduct welding training, you know, whatever, burning, whatever you need to do, cutting, torching, broco. And the exercise was to remove my Mark 20 mask, my full face mask, put a scuba reg in my mouth, get two breaths, give an okay to the instructor, don the Mark 20, the full face mask, dewater it, and then give an okay. What happened was I put the full face mask back on my face. I hit the purge button. I lifted it. I thought I had all the water evacuated, but I didn't. So I go to breathe and I just get a full on just mouthful of water immediately, blah, blah, you know, just start choking and choking. I pull the thing off and my instructor just jams a scuba reg in my mouth. And I just like had to cough through it. Just like, you know, and I mean, it was scary as hell, but what they're looking for is, are you going to solve the problem on the bottom? Or are you going to be the first one that looks up and bolts and panics to the surface? And like he stood there and he watched me. And then like, he kind of like, after I was coughing, you know, he looks at me and he's like, and I was like, and he had my full face. And I was like, you want to try again? I was like, mm-hmm, absolutely. Fill my lungs with air. And then just damn sure I made that thing purge and really lifted it up higher than I had the last time, which just got all the water out. So I put it and was like, please not have water. But I was like purging. Oh, there's the air. And I got the tip of air. And then I was like, I'm okay. He's like, you're okay. And poof, out the water you go. Next guy, you know, come on in. That was the moment I took on a big belly full of water and it scared the heck out of me. We don't have Hell Week. In the dive world, we have pool week. And pool week is a week where you are underwater and the instructor swims down and shakes you up a little bit. Gives you a little, you know, gives you a little bit of challenge, you know, maybe remove a mask, maybe pop a fin, strap. They call it the deep sea rodeo. You know, you're kind of on the bottom, you know, pawing around. Somebody swims down, takes all your stuff, and it gets more intense as the week progresses. That part of the training used to be used as a way to weed people out, but it wasn't the end of the world. You know, like the fact that there is a safety diver there, like, I'm like, these guys aren't trying to kill me. Do people get killed in training? Do people get hurt in training? Absolutely. But it's just like, it comes to that thing where like, when you've been hurt by someone who like a loved one or something, you know, like that's so bad. Like, you're not scared of that. You're not scared of a training environment because that's exactly what it is, a training environment. You can stop it at any time, you know? So, I mean, there is a lot of fear and it does push people to their very limits and people do quit, but that just wasn't getting to me. It's just, you know, let's, you know, shake me up in the water. I know I've got an air source right here. It is intense as it can possibly be. After dive school, we graduate, we go to ECS school, do our weapons training. And then my group, whoever I was with, I got stationed at Mudsu 1 in Hawaii. You know, first day things, first new command things, first command ever. I was trying to get into the main door of the high bay. I was pulling on the master diver's door and a couple divers drive by and they're like, hey, it's the master diver's door. What are you doing, man? So, okay. I guess I'll go through this door, you know, but yeah, there was some nerves showing up, you know, they're like, congratulations, you're here. And, so Mudsu 1 is diving salvage command. And, I felt like I've arrived. I was like, I'm okay. We're here now. I'm done with this training. I'm here. Let's go. And I was very, very fortunate. My first group of men who were my leadership, it was like the first time I was, you know, not only in dive school had I experienced this uplifting, this people coming around you to train you, but at Mudsu, my leadership was just people that wanted to support you, that wanted to see the best out of you. Some of the guys we fought, but it was like a brotherly fight. we never threatened to hurt each other. We never, you know, it never got that nasty. And so I was just enveloped in this tight brotherhood, and we were going on deployments and TADs together. And that's when I fell in love with what I was doing. The one thing that happened that was a get ready for where you're at type thing was a training dive. Hopped in the water with somebody else. I thought it was going to be a dog and pony kind of dive because he was a something high up, you know, and we get down to the bottom and he just goes limp. Didn't say anything. Didn't tell me this was a training exercise. And so immediately I was trained, okay, you got a stricken diver, pick them up, stand them up, get their head, you know, in an uptight position, you know, get them where they're breathing and you can keep their airway open, let topside know, and then, you know, they'll start pulling you up. That was one of the first ones that'd be like, okay, and we got out of the water and he coined me because he was like, good job. I could breathe the entire way up. He's like, I made my entire body limp as if I was dead. You stepped up to the challenge and thank you, you know, good job. I would dive any day with you, son. And I was like, thank you, sir. I appreciate it, you know? And so that was a good first moment. So we did 2 6-month appointments, almost back to back. We became closer. We came so close that we did our South Pack deployment. And then months later, they're like, look, guys, we've been here for so many years. We've trained up. You guys want to go to Bahrain? We got that on the table. Some of you might have to extend here and retain it at this command. And we looked at each other and we were like, yeah, let's do it. Let's go. We want to go. So I did a Bahrain deployment, and that's when the F-18 went down. So that was, yeah, but they were both 6-month deployments. I got nicknamed the Bandwidth Bandit because I was on FaceTime a lot and I was using the sat phone a lot. So I talked to my wife as much as I could. Every moment I got, you know, I'd find a time, we'd FaceTime, depending, you know, sometimes it'd be early for her, late for me, whichever. I stay in touch, you know, and then try to just do as much work as possible. I didn't have kids at the time, which I think contributed to how successful and how I was able to do that mentally and how I was able to leave. And I know people leave their families a lot and go on deployments here or there. But even leaving my fiance was hard at the time. You know, she's my fiance. Leaving my wife was difficult. I don't know if I could do it now that I have kids. Come back from deployment from South Pacific for 6 months. My wife's home. My fiance at the time. We're still the ready team to go out. My wife is Canadian, and we get a distress call from a Canadian ship right off the coast of Oahu, about 5 nautical miles out. And so I've just got back from deployment. I'm just getting that reconnection with my fiance, and I get a call, and it's like, hey, Tommy, we need you to leave tomorrow. There's a downed Canadian vessel that's like down cold iron hard. And I had to sit there and tell my wife, hey, look, I'm leaving again. But we're going to save Canadians. We're going to help the Canadians. So come on, it's your country, right? And she was like, all right, it's my people. Go do your thing, buddy. And so we towed in, gosh, I can't remember what the name of the boat was, but towed in a big Canadian ship. And that was a lot of fun. It was high seas when we got the line over, but it was a good group effort. So we shot a thin line from a shooter, and then we pulled over a bigger line from their boat, and then they pulled over the towing hawser. And that boat was down so hard that they had the entire crew out on deck heaving that line up so they could get it around something to, you know, their own bits to pull them in. I would say the most significant thing we did was the F-18 removal. We were deployed out in Bahrain, and, you know, we weren't doing any like really hardcore diving. We were kind of doing like pier sweeps and fuel barge diving, that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden an F-18 went down off an aircraft carrier in the sea. And so we got spun up, and they were like, the Navy wants their jet back, like right now. And we're not going to wait for a mixed gas console. We knew that where the jet was sitting was right at the end of our air table. If we went down for a dive, we only had 35 minutes to complete our task. The entire mission took 30 dives. I got to take part of two of those dives, which is a lot of fun. And a lot of us got narked. When I say narked, that's a dive term for nitrogen narcosis. Once you go down, usually past 100 feet, some people start getting a little lightheaded, they get a little funny, they start acting weird, they might start talking like babies. We were down to about 180 feet. And so you don't really feel it at first. You know, you go with your buddy and you go, you're looking up and you're seeing that boat just get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And you're like, okay, it's me and you. It's me and this guy down here. We're gonna get this done. And so I took a step off the stage and I inhale. And I had listened on the comms to other guys' conversations throughout the day, how they would step out off the stage and just start acting super weird. And they were talking like babies. And here I go. And I step off the stage and take my first like breath. I had to carry a wire pennant with me and then some extra umbilical line that I had, you know, so I could step out. And I start talking like a baby and I start getting a little confused and I drop the umbilical and I'm like, topside, I do not know where the umbilical is, you know. And I had my master diver who's like, just stay calm, just relax, Tommy, you're good, you know. And I was like, okay. And then I'm like, hey, wait, buddy, I'm like, green diver, can you turn around? Like, I'm lost, man. Like, I just got lost. And then he grabs me and he's like, all right, come this way. And so we put the pennant on the landing gear, the front of the forward part of the jet, put the shackle in, put the cotter key in the shackle, you know, ready to go. And I had a camera on my helmet. So I'm looking down at this, showing my master diver, showing topside what we're doing at the time. And the guy I was diving with, he helped me get back to the stage. We got back to the stage successfully and then went for that, you know, came back up after that. They actually had to have a crane come along the far side of the boat that we were on because it was so heavy to pull it up and pull it on deck. And so we got the whole thing on deck. We recovered everything and it was great. But I mean, that was the coolest moment in my entire dive career. We had the opportunity to go to Jordan and we were just doing basically like sweep the pier, sweep the tugs, to bring a U.S. ship in. And that was our mission. But while we were in Jordan, we got to experience the Movenpick. We got to experience diving the Red Sea. So it was like the guys I was with, it was like we would go on all these amazing little T-80 trips here, there. And just the things we would see on these trips, you know, the dive instructor that we had that led us through was this little German lady. And she's like, okay, I'm going to take you guys diving. And you know, I wouldn't really listen to her, what her brief was, when she's like, if you see this one fish, if you get stung by it, if you're lucky, you will die. And so we're like, what? Like, kind of perked up for that one moment. And she was like, these are stonefish. They will kill you. You know, and like, she's like, your arm will rot off so much, you'll wish you're dead. I was like, okay. And so this little lady took these husky deep sea divers out for this dive, you know, and she brought us to a ship. There was lionfish everywhere. She found a stonefish. And she looked at us and she was like, this was a symbol for stonefish. You know, she's like, right there, don't touch it. Don't let your fins hit the bottom. But she popped it up with her wand, her diving wand. I'd never seen one before with her diving wand. And that was pretty awesome. So we had these TADs that we'd shoot off and we'd always make friends there. And that was, you know, honestly, the biggest thing that came out of those appointments was the inception of 15 Fathoms. You know, the diving with different cultures, diving with Bangladesh, going to the Bangladesh dive school. That was a really good experience. Going to a couple different schools in Thailand, teaching them volleyball, building them volleyball nets, you know, doing outreach work was always good stuff. And I mean, we had fights, we had, you know, minor liberty issues, whatever, but it was always like, we were just a unit, you know, we always worked well together. After Hawaii, I got stationed at 32nd Street at Southwest Regional Maintenance Center, Naval Base North Island, underneath the Roosevelt. And I was in a doghouse cofferdam that we were fixing. It was on the main, like one of the main four shafts. And at this time, I'm wearing the full face mask and a hood, a little like a neoprene hood over my head. And so you swim up and it was grinding. I had made one trip back up to the swim step to get more grind wheels, because you don't want to make a bubble inside of your, in between your eardrum. You don't really mess with foamies while you're diving that much. I don't know if wearing cups over my ears, if I had brought some, like kind of like hooked to my dive, you know, to my belt would have changed anything. I'm just grinding, 4 hours grinding. I get out, get on surface, give an okay. I'm fine. 10 minutes goes by. I'm still fine, still kind of feeling kind of weird. And then I get on a phone call with a buddy of mine who I hadn't talked to in a while. And all of a sudden, I feel the boat doing this. And I'm kind of like, I'm doing this. And I'm like, I thought someone was just kind of waking us in the bay. And I'm doing this, but I'm not seeing any chain slap against the wall. And I'm not seeing any doors open. So I'm like, oh man, this is inside of me. And I've got this terrible motion inside of me. And I stand up and I'm kind of getting nauseous. And then like, now I'm freaked out. And now in my head, I know that there's something wrong neurologically with me. And so I started performing my own neuro. I start doing heel-to-toe walking. I start doing touching my nose with my fingers extended. You know, somebody finally noticed. And so my buddy comes back there and he's like, hey, man, I've been seeing you give yourself a neurological exam for the past 10 minutes. Are you okay, man? And I was like, no, dude, I'm nauseous. I want to throw up right now. And I was starting to act weird too. I was starting to act out of character, which is another indication of neurological deficit when you have a diving injury. So I started like, and this is after hours. This is like 5 o'clock. And I started like squaring away my uniform. Yeah, I didn't have to have a uniform on, you know? So I started acting weird. And I'm getting more and more paranoid, more and more freaked out. I got them to bring me home. And by the time I got home and I upped the elevator, you know, I told the guy that I was in the truck with, you know, don't worry about it, bro, I'm good. But like going through the hallway, I was just struggling to keep myself up because I was falling into the walls. So I get home, my wife sees me, and the first thing she says is, you're white as a ghost. And she calls the doc. He talked to a few people, and then he comes and brings me to the chamber. Well, I had to do a treatment table 6 with full extension. Still kind of wonky, still with some vertiginous symptoms, some vertigo. I had ringing out of my ears. You know, like I could tell my hearing was different, you know. And as I was grinding, when I was grinding that, it sounded like the noise started coming in weird. You know, I could almost feel that I was causing damage as I'm conducting this work. And like, I'm like, man, that is loud. But I just kept on going. But I didn't, you know, and I wish I had stopped. Maybe it would have helped. Maybe it wouldn't have. They get me in the recompression chamber, get me in. They do the full treatment. I get out. I'm still kind of off. Still, the nausea went away, but still just kind of like not able to really balance myself 100%. They had to wait a certain amount of time, and then I went to Bud's, and then they did. There's a chamber at Bud's, and we went there and did another one. Part of the protocol for when you get hurt is they go and they do a CAT scan. They give you a CT scan, and so I did a CT scan, and then they're like, I get a call from a doc, and he's like, "Hey Tommy, are you sitting down?" And I said, "Yeah," and he's like, "Well, you have a brain aneurysm also," and I'm like, "Oh shit!" Like, okay, an unruptured aneurysm, and I'm like, "All right." And so now on top of everything else, they're like, now you have an aneurysm. And then I had a doc that I was kind of assigned to that was treating me. And he's like, Tommy, I'm gonna be 100% honest with you. They're not gonna let you continue, you know? So you could fight all you want for a waiver. But when it comes to something like that, something like this, you're gonna have to switch rates, dude. Or fight for retirement. And I said, all right, well, I was already in such a broken place at the time that I was like, I'm going to fight for retirement. I'm going to get away from all this. I'm going to, you know, like, okay, this happened. Boom, restart again. I restarted my life over 8 years ago. I can restart my life again. You know, let's start working towards getting out. And it broke my heart because it was like everything I told you, all the wonderful things I just said about, you know, being accepted, being in a brotherhood, having these other men come around me and help train me and want to see the best in me. It's like, I knew I was losing all that and I was terrified and it was horrible because I liked it. I loved it. I had no intentions of getting out. I was looking forward to my next command and it really did mess me up. It really hurt. That was kind of the beginning of the end right there. It was a process of complete uncertainty because you don't know what they're going to say. You're waiting on them to make a decision. You're waiting on the powers that be to make a decision with what you're doing. I'm starting to get my plan together. What am I going to do? Where am I going to go? What's my next career path going to be? Once the injury happened, I started seeing a therapist. I started talking to somebody about what I was going through. I knew a chapter of my life was closing. So I was scared, but I've always kind of been able to get my, you know, figure my way out through life and stuff. And so I said, okay, well, we're going to move on and go to Canada. And so I started setting my sights on just that. And like, that was a plan, go to Canada, start life there, do school, whatever, you know, and that was kind of the plan, but it was heartbreaking because it was my career is what I fought for. All that dive, you know, everything I put up with in dive school, you know, my life leading up to this, it was like, no more. It's over with, you know, the dream's over with. And so that was rough. That was really, really rough. And the more I talk to more veterans, the more I hear a lot of the same stories, but yeah. And it put me in a bad place. The big decision I was waiting for was, are they going to medically retire me or medically separate me? And so they decided to medically retire me, which is a game changer. I found myself in Canada. I officially retired a day after I landed in Canada. So it wasn't only getting used to civilian life, it was getting used to civilian life in Canada. And so it was a lot, it was a big shift because it just flips your entire world upside down, you know, and now you're in this different environment. You're living with parental figures, which is no good. So it was just kind of like a really weird paradigm shift. You know, it was like this: one day you're a Navy diver, one day you're a guy living in a basement, and the world's falling apart, you know, and there's COVID happening and you can't leave the house. And like, there was like a period where like, I didn't have a license, I couldn't leave the house. And I was just like, this is the worst, this is a low. And I started putting on weight, started drinking too much, started, you know, eating too much ramen at night, you know, and it just, I knew I was messed up. And I started seeing a therapist in Canada, and I met, probably at my lowest time, my lowest part of my life, met one of the best therapists that I'd ever met, ever. I was getting so bad that I was starting to have thoughts of hurting myself. And I don't have those thoughts anymore. I've moved past that. I've moved beyond that, you know, but what my therapist told me that really shattered me out of that was the breakthrough moment, the watershed moment was, all right, Tommy, you know, you just told me you thought about your wife walking into you in the tub, you know, or your kids walking into you in the tub, you know, or, you know, if you slit your wrist or whatever, or walking into the garage, if you hung yourself, whatever it is, you know, how would you feel if you walked in on yourself? When she told me that, it pulled so much up out of me. She said, what if you saw yourself laying there dead? And I said to myself, I'd be like, what did you do, Tommy? You fool. You have two beautiful kids and a wife. You're alive, man. You lost a little bit of yourself, but you're still alive. You still experience life. Go on. And that was the moment. That was the moment with my therapist that fucking changed everything. And I decided right then and there, you know, and this is kind of how I've always been, but like, you know, I don't know who gets to hear this, but if you're unhappy with your life, if you're in the least bit, change that shit or work towards changing your life. Because I've been in quite a few situations where I've been unhappy. I don't stick around if I'm unhappy, if my family's unhappy. I figure out a way to get through that and to move on. And hearing that, you know, hearing that perspective from a good therapist was so, so valuable in my own life. And so I preach therapy because I believe in it, because I believe it can save people from very, very sunken places and then pull them out of of horrible headspaces. And, you know, just talking to a buddy is good. Sometimes you need a brain wrangler. Sometimes you need somebody that literally studies the human behavior year after year to give you some perspective of what you're thinking is wrong or what you're thinking isn't a healthy behavior. But I want to go back a little bit. I make it through dive school. I show up in Hawaii and I meet this beautiful Canadian girl through a friend of a friend. There was no Bumble or whatever at the time. You know, we just met completely organically. I knew I still had all this anger and all this pain and all this, like, you know, resentment to my own dad inside of me. And I just met this woman. I met this beautiful woman who I'm like, I'm thinking long, you know, long term with her. You know, there has to be a level of self-awareness there. And I said, you know what? I'm going to sit down with a therapist and I'm going to work through this. And I mean, there is, you know, the reason what really prompted me was me having jealousy issues with my own wife and or with my at the time girlfriend, you know, and what it was I looked at her Facebook and saw pictures I didn't like, and it got me angry. But I knew I could see through that anger that the Facebook thing was just the Trojan horse to allow me to let all my anger out. And so I knew I had to sit down with a professional to square myself away so I have a successful marriage with my wife. And that's kind of where my therapy journey like started, was getting myself prepared to be in a healthy, non-toxic, loving relationship with somebody that I knew in my heart and soul that I wanted to be with for the rest of my life. My wife has been nothing but an angel from the whole thing. She only wants to see the best of me. She only wants the best of me. She only wants the best of Tommy to come out of me. Everything I need emotionally, she tries to do her best to provide. And at the same time, taking care of our children, which, you know, you get out, you get out processed. I don't care if you're medically separated, if you left on your own accord, whatever it is. When you go through that shit, you're dragging your wife with you. You're dragging your kids with you. When you go through that depression, that sad, that fraction of time where you know things are messed up, you're dragging them all with you. You know, I got yelled at a lot as a kid. I got screamed. There was a period of my life when I got screamed at a lot. And my dad, when he would finally start simmering down a little bit and be like, you know why I scream at you so much? You know how my dad was to me? And he'd say that. He'd say, you know how my dad, so he'd pass the buck and he wouldn't take accountability. You know, and my dad and I are fine now. I love my dad. I love him forever. You know, he's one of those loves you, but has a funny way of showing it. You know, during my depressed time, getting angry, you get into what I call is a angry dog situation where, like, you know, you have an angry dog and he's in the corner and he's foaming at the mouth. And even if you come at him real soft with a treat, he's still going to bite your hand. You get in that angry dog headspace where you're just a monster, right? I've gotten angry and I've yelled at my kids. And then I have that remorse inside of my heart. But one thing I never, ever, ever do is I never pass the buck. I never say, well, you should have seen how Papa Todd used to yell at me. Well, you should have seen how Papa Tommy used to yell at Papa Todd. I'll never do that. Breaking the cycle of childhood trauma is one of my personal goals for my family, is I'm not going to raise my kids in any kind of a toxic household. I'm going to have a good, healthy marriage, good, healthy fatherhood, and raise up prosperous kids that don't have hangups, you know? So after my transition, we were in Canada. It was a year of COVID. It was insane. I eventually came to a point where I said, this isn't working out. I'm from Louisiana originally. It was kind of a natural move. I told myself, look, you know, the kids got to know your mom and dad. Now let's go to Louisiana, let them know my mom and dad and stuff, and try to do life down there. So I did school for a little bit. The voc rehab program is incredible. It wasn't really satisfying the need that I had to take care of the entire family. So I had to seek employment. I did so in Louisiana, which was wonderful. And as I seeked employment, things started getting better and better. I started feeling more like myself. I'm working in the maritime industry, which is kind of a one-off of what I was doing before. So that feels good as well. And then that job took me back here to San Diego. And now where I'm working, it's 100% fulfilling. It's a gratifying job and I love it. Like I said before, you know, when you're in a situation you don't want to be in, you find yourself a better situation. And so I seeked out a job that would bring me closer to the community that I called home. I seeked employment for a job position that will bring me closer to what I know and what I love. I love it here in San Diego. I love the Navy, you know, and I love my family. My girls were both born here, so this is their natural home. I retired out of here. And so a lot of those bad things that I experienced, I look at them with value, you know, because it really has, it shaped me as a person, and it's helped me become more of a stable person, helped me become more of a calm person, individual, and can be happier living here. You physically feel the layers of depression lift off as you're moving towards something that you want to do. When you're living life for you and your family, and you're doing, you know what you're doing is the best, and things are working, start working out, you do start feeling that, but you can't give up when you're at your bottom. That's the hard part. It's like when you're at that bottom part, when you're right here, is the digging deep and saying, no, I'm not giving up. Let's keep going. Let's grow. Our first deployment, we had dove with, I think, Bangladesh divers. We had a rim pack. So we met a bunch of Aussie divers, Chinese divers, all kinds of divers from everywhere, you know. And what I noticed through diving with international people is that we communicate once we leave surface, and we can chat, and we still know what's going on. And I had a lot of really awesome experiences diving with people from other countries. And so I want something that represents this. I want to wear something that represents this. I found one shirt with a Mark V on it when I was in dive school that I had from Etsy. And I kind of grew out of it, you know, but I was like, you know what? I came to a point where I was on deployment. I was in a hotel for about 10 days with nothing going on. And I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to pull the trigger. And I'm going to call it 15 Fathoms. And so basically with the inspiration behind the company is 15 Fathoms is a quantification of length. And it's 90 feet. Or one fathom is 6 feet. So That 90 feet is the same length of one shot of anchor chain. Before, they had sounding devices and they could measure with sound. They would plumb the bottom to drop anchors to do a 4-point moor when ships were out at sea. So after the bottom was plumbed, they would pay out an extra 15 fathoms of anchor chain, because that was the strength member that kept that 4-point moor secure. That no matter what sea state happened to that boat, 15 fathoms on each side is what's going to hold that boat together. And so when I dive with somebody else, I always look into their eyes. I look deep into their eyes, because that's going to tell me, are you ready to make this dive? Do you really want to do this dive? I know you can, but do you want to? And that's important too. Do you have to have a bond like iron with somebody to know that if something goes wrong with my gear, I can breathe off your regulator. If something goes wrong with your gear, I've got you, dude. And so that was the inspiration of 15 Fathoms, was diving with people from other countries and just having that bond with complete strangers. One of my mentors in the like clothing world was like, t-shirt's almost like a tattoo you wear for the day. You know, I mean, a t-shirt can be just a t-shirt, and sometimes it is just that, but sometimes it's something that you love. And I'm a t-shirt guy, so it was like, let's go. Let's make 15 Fathoms and share this love of diving with everybody else. You search 15fathoms.com. Just underneath the quantification of 15 Fathoms, you can you'll see our website. I would say last word for anybody. If you personally do not like your situation, change it. And if it's one tiny step, if it's one application, if it's one movement in the right direction, good on you. Keep doing it. And get to a place where you are happy and you can thrive, because we only got one. We got one body, one life to live. So live it your best.